This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Vice President Kamala Harris waking up in battleground Wisconsin today after rallying Friday, minutes ago.
The road to the White House definitely runs through Milwaukee, and I'm honored to have the support of people here.
Both Harris and former President Trump will be in North Carolina today.
North Carolina has been Democrats' sort of white whale. They really want this one. President Obama won here in 2008. They think it is doable. President Biden got closer in 2020. Another big factor here, there's a pretty popular Democratic governor who's term limited out, and the Republican candidate in that race has been pretty problematic, pretty controversial. Trump and Vance haven't really wanted to campaign with him.
ABC's Mary Ellis Parks, former Louisville, Kentucky police officer Brett Hanekison, found by a federal jury to have violated Breonna Taylor's civil rights during a botched raid on her home that led to her death. He faces a maximum of life in prison. Richard Moore put to death Friday night in South Carolina for the 1999 shooting of a convenience store clerk. This is ABC News. In Orlando, a state of emergency remains in effect for the city's popular downtown area following a fatal shooting as crowds were out celebrating Halloween. ABC's Victor Akendo has more.
A gunman seen walking up to a victim, opening fire, sending thousands running for their lives downtown. Moments later, a second shooting right in front of police. Body camera video showing officers taking the suspect down.
Get on the ground! Get on the ground right now!
A college student among the two people killed. Authorities charging a 17-year-old boy with two counts of first-degree murder and six counts of attempted murder.
The FBI and U.S. intelligence officials say Russia's behind a fake video now circulating online showing a man who claims to be a Haitian immigrant who says he voted multiple times in Georgia. Again, that video completely fake. U.S. intelligence and Homeland Security officials are warning that Russia, China, and Iran are engaged in a broad covert campaign to divide and confuse Americans. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was. When they moved the camera, whenever they leave like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Straight. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media radio network and on the Civic Media app.
Lena Bloom for The Bail Project.
Imagine you're stuck in a jail cell and you can't afford bail and someone offers you a way out. Just plead guilty and you can go home and kiss your kids goodnight. What do you do? What thousands have. You plead guilty whether you are or not. Cash bail makes poverty a crime. That's why The Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting to end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin's voter ID law can be a nightmare for college students. They can use their student ID, but only if it's compliant with state rules, and most aren't. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
On some campuses, students need to request a special ID that includes their photo, legal name, signature, issuing date, and expiration date. Kristen Hansen with Common Cause in Wisconsin works with college students to help them vote. She says state law just makes it difficult.
This is one of the things that is a mystery, is a school already knows the student is who they say they are. They've already provided identification to the school. And so the ID that the school gives should be enough without all this other nonsense attached to it.
Hansen says another challenge for students is providing proof of residency, as some can change addresses every year they're enrolled. Meanwhile, out-of-state students face additional hurdles in registering to vote. Molly Ford, an out-of-state senior at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, is very familiar with these hurdles. This is her first time voting in a presidential election, but she voted in the state's general election 2 years ago. She says she almost missed one of her class finals because she had to run back to her dorm to get a document after having already stood in line.
My friend that was in the class was like, "You're crazy. I would have just not done that." And I was like, well, it was important to me to vote in this election.
Ford says although her school has been proactive about promoting the student vote, it would be helpful to know more about what exactly is needed to cast a ballot. You can get that information online at myvote.wi.gov. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. Tonight, rain after midnight, low of 42. Rain is likely for Sunday, with highs in the low 60s. Sunday night, showers and storms, temperatures around 60 degrees. For Monday, more rain and a high near 69.
Right now, it's 37.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Derek Mosley from the Lubar Center at Marquette University will be here to break down the latest polls, and we will wrap it up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. News from the Center, WRCE. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is the second hour of our weekend weekly broadcast about all things government-related, court-related, rule of law-related. My name is Jim Santel for your host this second hour of our broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, focusing upon this claim, these more than 100 threats during the course of the campaign that Donald Trump has made to prosecute or pursue or in some way go after his perceived enemies, political or otherwise. He has said that publicly in the campaign. He's going to prosecute those people who are in opposition to him, asking and hopefully answering somewhat the question of whether or not he can use the Department of Justice for that purpose. How successful could he be under the present structures of our Constitution, under the laws of our nation? Can he accomplish that? And the answer is a no, with a very small n, with some very significant aspects of that, however, that do have important implications for the operation of the Department of Justice. Spending a lot of our time already in our first hour talking about this appointment power that the president has, attorneys general, assistant attorneys general, United States attorneys, all of them, of course, subject to review by the advice and consent of the Senate. The Senate balks at some of those nominees, perhaps the president needs to go back and find a candidate or candidates more acceptable to the Senate. But again, depending upon the composition of the Senate, that too, that body too, could endorse the appointment of what Donald Trump has called political loyalists in the position of the Department of Justice, who would effectively carry out his and not the independent Justice Department initiatives. And that's problematic. And that is contrary to 240 years of our history, an arm's length relationship between the Department of Justice and the presidency itself. Now, that appointment process, of course, implies that the United States Senate will have a role in that process. But there is a certain vagary, a certain aspect of the law that also gives Donald Trump and every president at the start of his or her presidency some leeway with respect to putting people in place who may not have gotten Senate confirmation yet. Now, what does that legislation say? Basically, it says this. If there are vacancies, as there certainly would be in the first portions of any administration, as people leave those positions, go into private practice, do other things out there, those vacancies, and under the law, they could be filled. And that would include some of the department's top ranks, including those assistant attorneys general, the associate attorney general, the attorney general himself, without Senate confirmation for, and here's the focus, up to 300 days at the start of administration. 300 days, that's about 10 months, according to my inaccurate and sometimes halting math. 300 days is what the law says. The president has the capacity to appoint people across the board, including the Department of Justice, to people who are not confirmed expressly for those positions by the Senate. Now, here's the rub. Here is the condition on that. He would be limited to a pool of candidates who would be senior Justice Department employees already in place, people who are there, or Senate-confirmed officials, or both. People have already gotten into these positions. You can't just go out and pluck folks from the private sector who've never been a part of the process, the government systems before. So there is that limitation. But you can find people inside the Department of Justice, find people who have previously been Senate-confirmed for other positions who would be available to and could be appointed even in those 300 days without express new Senate confirmation. And that's a huge authority. That's a huge responsibility. Now, the other piece of this, of course, that we've talked about a lot is this thing called Schedule F. It's already inside the AFPI, the America First Policy Institute manifesto, if you will. And we know that Donald Trump could basically reissue, yes, that's right, reissue what he called Schedule F at the end of his prior administration. This is the document. This is the executive order that effectively would say that all civil servants are now at-will employees and would give the presidency, the president himself, the chief executive, the power to convert all those positions into at-will employees and fire them if they do not advocate for or even publicly advocate for positions they're in opposition to those of the White House. He could issue an executive order removing civil service protections so that the attorney general, for example, inside the Department of Justice, one application of this could quite literally fire thousands of nonpartisan, nonpolitical, expert career lawyers and agents. And in fact, Donald Trump, as you know from our previous discussions, did in fact issue an order in 2020. It was known as Schedule F. And it's a part of Project 2025. And it's a part of the project of the America First Policy Institute to put that back in place. And it's a blueprint for, again, getting rid of the civil service, changing not only the Department of Justice, the civil servants who are there, the nonpartisan people, converting them into at-will employees who can be fired for disloyalty, fired for non-discriminatory reasons that go to more their policy views than their actual ability to do the job. That is a huge power if, in fact, he accompanies his presidency, the first days of his presidency, accompanies his entrance into the Oval Office with this execution of a renewed Schedule F. Now, you may say, well, gee, why is it that Schedule F is not in place today? It's because Joe Biden, when he was sworn in on January 20th, the start of his term, immediately rescinded that and effectively restored, if you will, any diminution, any destruction to the civil service that might have happened if Schedule F had remained in place in the wake of the Trump administration. It's no longer in effect today. Donald Trump could take it off the shelf once again, reissue it, and change civil service under these proposals advanced by the Heritage Foundation, by AFPI, and do that with an executive order. How is that implicated with the Department of Justice? Again, changing the agents, changing the lawyers who are supposed to do their job based upon the law and the facts, independent of White House prerogatives, change them into at-will employees, fireable by an attorney general, by a president, if, in fact, the president does not like what they're doing, views them as disloyal to his or her particular prerogatives. Now, there are some major ways, then, that the president can change the Department of Justice, putting in place for a term or for the consistency of his entire administration people who are loyal to him. That Trump versus United States opinion on July 1 further underscores the authority of a president almost unfettered to engage in communications and engagements like this with the Department of Justice that would permit him to do that with impunity. That's why this is such a great concern. That's why this changes so dramatically, not only the application of our Constitution, which the Supreme Court effectively did on July 1, but also the ways in which the Department of Justice is designed and commissioned to serve you, to advance the interests of justice and rule of law, to apply the facts and laws to the cases that are in court, And the other major aspect of this, of course, is that there are some guardrails out there having to do with investigations, having to do with the movement of investigations into courts, into grand juries, into the judicial process itself, into the public domain, that do in fact provide some guardrails for a president like Donald Trump, who might plan on using the Department of Justice to change all these folks into non-civil servants, to have them do his bidding. There are some guardrails, but they're limited when it comes to investigations in particular, much stronger, much more robust when it comes to actual presentations to a grand jury, actual presentations in the court of law, where there are more safeguards, more checks and balances on the unfettered actions of loyalists who could be otherwise installed into the Department of Justice. We're going to talk more about those as our discussion here continues. That discussion necessarily includes, of course, our listeners. We invite, as always, your questions, your inquiries about the subject matters of our discussion here on Amicus Law Review. That phone-in number is 855-752-4842. That's 855-752-4842. That is the number. Be a part of our discussion. You can also drop comments, questions, inquiries into the Civic Media app. Go to Amicus Law Review and contact us that way. We are delighted, as always, to take those questions, those inquiries. They add so much to our conversation, especially right now, this day, and in the days ahead, following the coming election, whatever happens on Tuesday, once the counts are all completed, whatever happens, focus once again on even more the importance of the rule of law and justice, regardless of who America elects to be its next chief executive. Delighted this morning to have Jack from Merrimack calling in. Jack, appreciate your call, your question, your inquiry here on Amicus.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for taking my call. Well, let's see now.
Lots to discuss, right, Jack? Lots to discuss.
Yeah. First of all, it's definitely pretty bad that a president can do essentially what Donald Trump did, which is appoint either incompetence or even worse yet, people who are antithetical to the purposes of organizations like the Department of Labor or like the EPA. And as heads, and if he's got enough political swing, which he did in the first 2 years of his administration, he can get those people into those positions. But now the Supreme Court has essentially said he's got royal-like immunity.
Absolutely.
From prosecution to almost anything he does, including up to and apparently, because he still hasn't been prosecuted on it, an attempted insurrection. Now he wants dictatorial powers. What is America coming to? Are we turning into a third world authoritarian country? This is absolutely crazy. And the worst part of it is I've had discussions with people who are Trump fans, and one of them actually said something like, if I wanted to live in a democracy, I wouldn't be voting for Donald Trump. Excuse me?
Yes, just the opposite, right? Right? And Jack, you've encapsulated just perfectly, right? It's this combination of Supreme Court authority to do what you want with impunity and get away with it, and then this adoption of these policies and these practices to load up the Department of Justice with people who will do your bidding. It is a 1-2 punch. And again, depending upon who we elect for the president, we've got a present president who doesn't invoke those authorities. One of the candidates, Kamala Harris, would not do that either, but Donald Trump would. And he has said exactly that. Jack, appreciate so very much your articulation of exactly what the challenge is and why voting on Tuesday is so very important. Thank you for your comment, your inquiry, Jack, and we'll continue this discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Social Security is the backbone of the American retirement system. Yeah, 401ks and IRAs are very important, and yes, I talk about them a lot, and I definitely want you to have them. But Social Security supports most Americans in retirement and is an essential lifeline for tens of millions more. I love Social Security because it is so simple. You work hard, you pay in, and then you get your money back when you need it to make your golden years better. There's a conservative agenda out right now that's going to add between $7.5 and $15 trillion to the national debt. Ballooning national debt is, I think, the biggest threat to Social Security that there is. We want less national debt and a better funded Social Security program. This is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about the things that a president, including Donald Trump, including Kamala Harris, although she would choose not to exercise any of these authorities, things a president can do with respect to the Department of Justice that would go after political rivals. As Donald Trump has said, made more than 100 threats to do so during the course of this campaign. It is believable that he would at least attempt to pursue this. And yes, the first step would be embedding inside the Department of Justice, inside U.S. attorneys' offices, people who are loyal to him. That is an option that he would have. Again, subject to the guardrail is subject to confirmation by the Senate, with the exception of this legislation that permits him to appoint people already inside the system for 300 days. The bottom line is he does have considerable authority to put people in those positions, as does any president who would advance his views. And that's okay on a general theoretical viewpoint. But when it comes to particular prosecutions of particular individuals, that's where the problem comes in. And that's the reason why this is so very dangerous, as Jack was just identifying in our previous segment. Now, what happens beyond that? You've got the loyalists in place. You've got the people who are going to do your bidding. Can Donald Trump go ahead and actually initiate investigations and even beyond that, prosecutions of these people? And the answer is yes and no. Yes and no. There are some guardrails that make it more difficult for him to do this, but it's not impossible. Once Trump loyalists are in place, they could begin taking some actions that the other branches of government could not initially stop. The executive, of course, according to the Supreme Court, is very, very speedy, very, very powerful and muscular. And those loyalists, again, if they're in place, could begin to open investigations. You could open a fresh investigation of critics or revive claims that his allies have so far failed to substantiate, including allegations of corruption inside the Biden administration that predate his presidency. All kinds of things could be initiated, opening a file, typically not in the public domain. A Trump-appointed attorney general, again, subject to Senate confirmation, could tap someone inside the criminal division. There is an assistant attorney general for the criminal division, an assistant attorney general for all sorts of things, national security, civil litigation, tax, environment, antitrust, a special counsel, or even a U.S. attorney who the president nominates to lead an investigation that Donald Trump wants to have happen. You could open the file itself. And the significant thing there is that the goal of punishing an enemy could, in a sense, be considered accomplished. How? Well, investigations alone, as we know, can cause harm to the finances, certainly hiring lawyers, requiring to be defending against an investigation. The reputation of a target could be impugned if that leaks into the public domain, which it shouldn't, but could. Even without an indictment or a conviction, one of the things that's often said, of course, very mindful of this fact, this is the reason why prosecutors, including me and many, many others as U.S. attorneys, always decline to confirm or deny the existence of an investigation unless there is some overwhelming public need to know. The old saying says the process of investigation can be the punishment if it is abused, as Donald Trump would propose. The very investigation itself could be the punishment that he is seeking against his rivals, even though it may not result in an indictment. And that's the other great stop against this. The baseless investigations could be initiated and could be pursued, again, not yet in court, until you reach some of the processes that are contemplated by our Constitution and by the laws of our nation. How do you go about stopping an investigation from going even further? You know the answer. You know the answer. And the answer, of course, is we've got this thing called the grand jury. James Madison wrote it. into our Constitution that says before you can charge anyone with a federal crime, you have to go before a grand jury. Grand jury, 26 people. Who are those folks? They're not appointed by the president. They're not state officials. They're you. They're people called in. They are selected by the courts. They're a part of the judicial system. And they're called upon in private to review evidence to determine whether there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And in 30 years of my own practice, it has been my universal, uniform sense and experience that grand juries take their jobs very seriously. Grand juries take their jobs so seriously that they're also compelled, they're required, to determine whether or not the government has presented its case, that there is a real case, or that the facts, the law support the return of charges. The one of the most significant things a government can do, a grand jury indictment formally charging someone, cannot be done in the federal system without the imprimatur, without the consent of a grand jury. That's a huge stop on an unfettered presidency, an unfettered Department of Justice. And if the grand jury says that we do not agree, that's called returning a no true bill. That's another portion of your civics instruction this weekend. That no true bill basically would stop the prosecution if a majority of the grand jury says, you know what, this is political. This is not a violation of the federal criminal law. We can stop this, and that's a significant stopgap. That's a guardrail on an investigation going even further. Now, that's not to say, of course, that the investigation itself already indicated would not have its implications. You hire attorneys then. You defend against the investigation even as it is going before the grand jury. But grand juries, for the most part, are competent and they are responsible. And they are a significant, that's what James Madison wanted them to be, a significant restraint on the capacity of an executive branch to do exactly what Donald Trump wants to do. Of course, we've also got other mechanisms to stop that. We've got whistleblower protections inside the Department of Justice. In that connection, there's also a unit called the Office of the Inspector General. All the agencies of the federal government have those as well. You've heard about the IG for various agencies, including the Inspector General for the Department of Justice. They're a quasi-independent group of lawyers and agents and investigators who determine, they look internal to the Department of Justice and determine whether or not there have been violations of basic practices and conduct inside the Department of Justice. The Inspector General could, in fact, pursue investigations of politically motivated, partisan-based investigations. That's another stopgap on all this. And that's the reason why, even though the president has huge numbers of appointees that he can make, subject to Senate confirmation, the investigations could be initiated, files could be opened wrongly if, in fact, they're motivated only by political animation. And again, note that files can be opened if there is some basis to believe that a crime has been committed. It is not the case. It is not the case. And it is a violation of the oath of office for any of those appointed people, U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys who, yes, are civilly service protected up to now anyway. It is a violation of their oath of office to open a file just based upon some political animus or simply based upon the notion that I think that this particular person may have committed a crime. You got to have some colorable basis upon which to open a file, not because you don't like someone, not because you think their posture in the community is inappropriate. You've got to have some reason to believe. Doesn't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. Doesn't have to be probable cause, but something to justify the initiation of investigation. That's also a check on all of this. And then we've got the third major check, which is, of course, the judicial system itself. Once you have indicted, if indeed somehow you're able to prosecute and go into courts, you've got the check of not only the grand jurors who are court officials, but also district court judges, appellate court judges, another branch of government, out there also to determine whether or not what's happened up to this point is legitimate. And those courts routinely entertain motions to dismiss indictments based upon lack of evidence, motions to quash evidence if, in fact, there have been acquisitions of evidence contrary to the Constitution, contrary to the Fourth Amendment, other principles out there. All of that is also a stopgap. We'll talk more about that as Amicus Law Review continues in our discussion of whether or not the Department of Justice and other trappings can be used to go after political rivals of a sitting president.
News from the Center, WRCE.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Vice President Kamala Harris waking up in battleground Wisconsin today after rallying Friday, minutes ago.
The road to the White House definitely runs through Milwaukee, and I'm honored to have the support of people here.
Both Harris and former President Trump will be in North Carolina today.
North Carolina has been Democrats' sort of white whale. They really want this one. President Obama won here in 2008. They think it is doable. President Biden got closer in 2020. Another big factor here, there's a pretty popular Democratic governor whose term limited out, and the Republican candidate in that race has been pretty problematic, pretty controversial. Trump and Vance haven't really wanted to campaign with him.
ABC's Mary Ellis Parks, former Louisville, Kentucky police officer Brett Hanekison, found by a federal jury to have violated Breonna Taylor's civil rights during a botched raid on her home that led to her death. He faces a maximum of life in prison. Richard Moore put to death Friday night in South Carolina for the 1999 shooting of a convenience store clerk. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Badgers take on Iowa. I'm Mike Clemens with sports. College football, it's Wisconsin against the Iowa Hawkeyes tonight at Kinnick Stadium. Both teams 5-3, kick off a little after 6:30. NBA, the Bucks are at home against the Cavaliers tonight, trying to snap a four-game losing streak. Damian Lillard says when he was with the Trailblazers, he'd just take over games. How hard is that now?
It's hard because, I mean, my entire career, I've always been somebody who, if I can do one thing, I can take over. You know, I think I've joined a new team in my The situation is different. I understand it is different, so I have to try to, you know, find a way to not just go back to what I've always done because it's probably not always necessary. So I think that's probably the most difficult part is like when things seem like it's getting out of control or the going is getting tough, you know, I'm able to put my hands on it a little bit more. And I think just not being in that role is, you know, it's a little bit more difficult.
That's the Bucks' Damian Lillard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. Tonight, rain after midnight, low of 42. Rain is likely for Sunday, with highs in the low 60s. Sunday night, showers and storms, temperatures around 60 degrees. For Monday, more rain and a high near 69.
Right now, 40 degrees.
Wisconsin has many state symbols, but did you know there's an official ballad?
Oh, Wisconsin, land of my dreams.
Oh, Wisconsin, land of my dreams, composed by Sherry Sarazin.
I don't think it was an hour, and I had the music matched up.
With long ago help from her grandmother.
She wrote a poem in the late 1920s about where she lived in Wisconsin.
And it's now the state ballad. So are these also official Wisconsin symbols? The Kringle, Wood Violet, American Water Spaniel? The answer coming up. The official process can take years and includes advocating the legislature to make it law. Now, along with the official ballad, are the Kringle, Wood Violet, and American Water Spaniel also state symbols? Yes, each is a celebration of the state and a slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
We visited Alexandria, Minnesota a few summers ago. Great time, lakes, fishing, all that. But this year, for the holidays, we wanted a winter vacation that was just as memorable, just as family-friendly, but with lights and snow, and this time, with our grandkids in tow. This holiday, it's Alexandria again. We're coming back to make new memories.
Explore your holiday getaway options at explorealex.com.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Professor Charles Franklin from Marquette University Law School. This is the last poll before we will go to the polls.
In the presidential race, we have it at a one-point Harris lead, 48 to 47, with 5% undecided. And how those people make up their minds, who to vote for or if to vote, that's easily enough to sway this race.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from our Madison studio, where I welcome King of the Hill and Futurama TV writer Mike Rowe and musician Eric Gelland from Mascot Theory joins me in the studio.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are spending most of our time this weekend talking about whether Donald Trump could really make good on his threat. And they have been threats, over 100 of them, to go after his political rivals using the Department of Justice, the trappings, the structures of it. And the answer is yes, he can appoint loyalists. He can appoint people who would do his bidding, establishing policy. And that's no small thing. That's no small thing. And it would affect and dramatically change the content, the atmosphere, the structure, the geography of the Department of Justice, undeniably. Question whether or not he would really be successful in prosecuting. Whole bunch of safeguards on that, guardrails on that, the grand jury being one of them, whistleblower protections inside the Department of Justice, people coming forward saying, you know what, this kind of thing is going on, it's partisan in nature. Of course, the big one is the grand jury system before an indictment can be issued. It's got to go through that rubric, then got to go through that process of getting a grand jury to agree with you. And again, my strong sense is that grand juries, part of the judicial system, but also independent and make their own determinations. And indeed, there are times when grand juries say no. And that's what they should do. That's a part of our system. So those checks are there. And then, of course, if there is some way, if somehow all of those stopgaps are not effective and it gets into the tribunal of a public entity, that is the federal trial courts, then you've also got the check and balance of what we'd like to think is also an independent judiciary and defense counsel who play a very important part of their responsibility to defend against both legitimate and, frankly, if this happens, illegitimate charges. They can bring motions to dismiss based upon lack of evidence, motions to quash evidence improperly gotten, motions to dismiss indictments based upon the nature of the charges, based upon the fact that it's not founded in a federal statute, all kinds of things. Defense counsel play a major role in defending against this kind of thing. And of course, they're appearing in front of whom? They're appearing in front of federal district court judges, ultimately appellate judges also, who also have standards and practices apart from, but related to the Department of Justice, apart from the decisions by prosecutors to prosecute. They've got an independent responsibility to look at those cases and determine whether or not they should be in court. And they've done that in the past in those very rare instances where indeed there is something about the prosecution that's not properly stated. Judges can, in fact, dismiss counts. We saw that recently, not because of political animation, but Judge Scott McAfee in that case pending in Georgia, Fulton County, dismissing some counts there because he said, you know what, the indictment here does not properly place Donald Trump and co-defendants on notice of what they have committed, the crimes they have undertaken. And so he dismisses those counts. That's our system at work. You can disagree with that. Fani Willis, the prosecutor, is disagreeing with that, taking that up on the Court of Appeals. But that's the process. It also provides a protection against an unfettered Trump administration, an unfettered attorney general who might choose to use the authorities of his or her office in a way that's contrary to the basic trappings of the Department of Justice. Of course, we also have a Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court itself, of course, is this entity that has recently issued this major opinion. Great trouble for the future of America should a president choose to exercise the powers given to him or her by that July 1 decision. concerns that I have less about the trial court judges in America, the appellate court judges in America, and more concerns about a Supreme Court these days, the highest court in the land. That court has plainly delivered to Donald Trump three different victories during the course of just the last term. Number one, finding that he can, in fact, be on the Colorado primary ballot and other primary ballots around the country. Secondarily, finding that indeed, when it comes to this Fisher case, that the statute charging Donald Trump and many, many other people on January 6th had to be narrowly viewed. An interpretation order that's still subject to review by the judge. Her name is Tanya Chutkan in the district court. That's a second victory for the Donald Trump team, if you will. And, of course, the major one being that immunity decision. Donald Trump has benefited from recent decisions of the Supreme Court that are arguably in the category of things that are partisan in nature. An awful lot of people looking at the Supreme Court today, as it's got record low levels of approval, saying that it has become a political entity. That's a matter for reasonable people to disagree about. But nonetheless, it is the ultimate stopgap in a system that in a good Supreme Court, a responsible Supreme Court applying the law to the facts would also stop a truly political prosecution. So the answer in the end is, Donald, you can go ahead and appoint a lot of people. You can initiate programs and projects in areas of importance like immigration, like law enforcement, like policing, all kinds of things inside the ambit of the Department of Justice. But you're going to find some difficulty when it comes to actually prosecuting people, even if you investigate them, begin that process down the road. All of that apart of what will be determined on Tuesday and beyond as we count the votes, figure out what the Electoral College says to us, and determine whether a next president would invoke these kinds of opportunities that Donald Trump has said he will invoke inside the Department of Justice with some authority of our United States Supreme Court. The coming election, of course, also prompts courts out there to engage in decision-making about the trappings of the election itself. And there are many cases around the country, state courts, federal courts that are addressing right now the terms and conditions, the circumstances under which voting in particular states will take place. Why does that happen? Why do we have all sorts of different rules and regulations being implemented around the country? And again, it's constitutional. It's James Madison stuff. James Madison wrote into our Constitution that the individual at times, places, circumstances of voting, even for federal elections, will be decided by the states. And that's why you've got different procedures with respect to mail-in voting, in-person voting, drop boxes, all these kinds of things. To some extent, the timing, the circumstances of how we vote are different from state to state because our Constitution says that. And along the way, what happens, of course, is as rules are changed by the election commissions in particular states, by county clerks, by the clerks responsible for administering the elections, there are challenges to those. And there are two in particular that reached the Supreme Court just this past week. On Wednesday, the United States Supreme Court allowed the state of Virginia to purge about 1,600 people from its voter rolls, handing a temporary but major victory to some officials in the state who said that that move was necessary to prevent non-citizens from voting. Now, once again, is this a major problem in America? The answer, of course, is no. We do not have non-citizens voting in America. It's virtually impossible for that to happen. It's also a reason why one of those referendums on the ballot here in Wisconsin is also appropriately shot down by our voting population. We don't need to reestablish that non-citizens cannot vote. We don't need to do that because that's the law already. That's the state law. That's the federal law. Citizens vote. Non-citizens do not vote. But in Virginia, an attempt to get rid of these non-citizens from voting prompted the governor there. His name is Glenn Youngkin, Youngkan. He signed an executive order back in August, not too far away from the election itself, to expedite. Let's move this forward. He said, make this happen quickly. Suspected non-citizens on the state's voter rolls. In instigating this program, he insisted again that only non-citizens were effective, getting rid of people off the rolls, though some anecdotes were indicating that registered voters properly there
We don't know other numbers. We don't know exactly the stories behind them. May have been mistakenly removed from those roles. 1,600 people were flagged as possible non-citizens through two paths, according to some of the folks involved in the litigation. One group, about 600 people, had marked themselves as non-citizens on forms at the Department of Motor Vehicles. A second group, about 1,000, had marked themselves as citizens on DMV forms, but had previously listed some alien registration number, all of that giving rise to concern about who they are. And that's the point. As this thing goes ahead and challenges are made to it, including a challenge by, yes, that's right, the civil litigation attorneys of the Department of Justice challenging this very program, saying basically it's moving too quickly. What you're doing by throwing all these people off is you're casting a net that's too broad. You're getting rid of people who might be entitled to vote. Don't do that. Don't do that. And voters were flagged as potentially ineligible. They were sent some notifications by mail. They were given 2 weeks to confirm their citizenship. Significantly, they can still confirm and they can vote by coming in and doing the same states, the same day voter registration there in Virginia that we have here. So there are remedies to this problem. But as this moved up into the courts, it ultimately went file on the desk, if you will, of the Supreme Court of the United States of America. And the order basically permits Virginia to go ahead, even in this uncertain time, to purge those 1,600 people from its voter rolls. This is the so-called shadow docket, the docket that requires immediate action. The order, which did not include a vote count, gave no reasoning, as is normally the case, is unsigned. But it noted, of course, predictably, that Justices Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson, the three in the minority, would have denied the state's request to continue the voter purge. Six members of the Supreme Court said, go ahead, continue that voter purge in Virginia. And that comes out of the United States Supreme Court just on Wednesday of this past week, prompting the governor, Glenn Youngkin, there. He says he welcomes this decision. It's a victory for common sense and election fairness. That's what the governor says in response to what happened there in Virginia. Significant because, plainly, it affects the right of 1,600 people to vote in Virginia. It may not throw the Electoral College itself because Virginia, not much in play. Likely, we know the result there even before all the votes are counted. But nonetheless, the important issue is voting, the franchise and access to it, by what the governor has done, this executive order to hasten the removal of these suspected non-citizens. You're compromising the capacity of people if they don't now turn around and re-register to vote very, very promptly. All of that coming out of Virginia, coming out of our United States Supreme Court just this past Wednesday. We've got another caller who's calling in. We appreciate so much Engel Maggie. Engel, do I have your name correctly? Delighted to have you with me this weekend as we talk about these issues related to voting here in America. Go ahead. Engel, do we have you with us? Yes? All right.
Maybe. This is Jerry from Madison.
Okay, Jerry, I guess I've got you improperly noted here, but Jerry, go right ahead. Go right ahead with your question or your comment.
You know, my dad, my grandfather, and people of age, 70, but my father had put a uniform on and with a gun, and they went and defended during World War II, leave it at that, and defended democracy. You know, for people my age, and sons and daughters of people who went to war and died, thousands of them, to vote somewhat anti democracy, Republicans are anti-democracy, Trump is nuts, and it's insane. That's all. I'm going to leave it at that.
And Jerry, appreciate the comment. And again, son of someone, and you, I'm assuming that you heard your stories, your father coming back, defending democracy overseas, defending democracy around the planet. We benefit from that to this day, and from the sacrifices that your dad and many, many other Americans made to preserve this republic. And now to have it undermined, as Jerry, you just said so very well, by people invoking theories and practices and policies that would try to undermine the very contributions that your father and you and others continue to make to our American experience it is not just problematic, it's not just contrary to who we are, but it's a reason to go to vote, to make certain that it is not a part of our future come January of 2025. Appreciate very much the comment, Jerry, coming into our broadcast this weekend. The Supreme Court is busy again in this period of time, not only focusing on things having to do with the election there in Virginia, that again removes from the rolls 1,600 people subject to their re-registering in advance of the election. Supreme Court also focusing on Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is indeed one of those seven states, a swing state, a battleground state, and the Supreme Court making a decision just in on Friday of this week, also affecting the capacity of people to execute, to submit provisional ballots in that state. We'll talk more about that as Amicus continues.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Oh no, stomach issues again?
Stomach issues?
Who are you?
Your pancreas. I could be the real reason for your diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose oily stools.
I thought it was my stomach.
People often do, but any of these symptoms could mean having a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and speak with your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
It's time to get out the truth about Eric Hovde. Hovde made his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. How can he relate or make decisions for us? Now he's the CEO of a billion-dollar bank in California and a huge landlord. With people like Eric Hovde, the rich pay less, and we pay the price. I'm not a political person. I'm a mom. I would never vote for a person like Eric Hovde.
Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action. ABWT-Action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus Solario. My name is Jim Santel, talking about what the United States Supreme Court has done and not done in connection with votes coming in this coming November 5th. Focusing first upon this decision to permit the state of Virginia to go ahead with its purging of 1,600 votes, going in the opposite direction, if you will, just as late as Friday. In another case coming out of Pennsylvania, again, Pennsylvania, one of the major battleground states, no decision here to stop something from going ahead there. Supreme Court on Friday clearing the way for some voters in Pennsylvania whose mail-in ballots, and that's the focus of this challenge coming up to the Supreme Court, the mail-in ballots deemed invalid, permitting them to cast provisional ballots in person, effectively rejecting an appeal not to count votes. Decision, again, unsigned, no reasoning, common, again, in these emergency petitions. And, again, it is significant because it could affect thousands of mail-in ballots in this state, Pennsylvania, you know well, it's crucial to each party's path to victory on Tuesday of this coming election. Paths, the polls show that the paths for both Kamala Harris and former President Trump to regain and acquire the presidency go right through Pennsylvania, Wisconsin as well, but other places as well. What has happened, of course, is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled last week that the voters there whose ballots were rejected, a number of issues here about dating and all sorts of other things that are hyper-technical, superficial, non-substantive aspects of their vote, among them ruling that ballots were rejected for failure to use the secrecy sleeves. This is sort of an internal secrecy envelope that they could, in fact, cast provisional ballots. In a 4-3 ruling, the lower court concluded that officials in a place called Butler County, western part of the state, must accept provisional ballots cast by voters after they realized that their mail-in ballots had been rejected because they did not have those so-called secrecy sleeves. Again, a process required by the peculiarities of Pennsylvania law, but nonetheless being identified as a reason to reject those mail-in ballots. The petition then taken up to the courts, and the allegation made that the decision by the Supreme Court there in Pennsylvania would dramatically change the rules governing mail voting after millions in the state had already cast their ballots. Comes up to the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court. And again, the United States Supreme Court basically says, or supports the lower court ruling there, clearing the way for those voters to cast provisional ballots, basically to permit them to vote in such a way that preserves their right to vote until the issue about the sleeves and other things are resolved, still permitting them to vote. The petitioners, the challengers, had asked the justices to pause that state court order, to stop it from going into effect, requiring election boards to count provisional ballots by voters whose mail-in ballots were previously deemed to be invalid. A lot of double and triple negatives there. Basically, Supreme Court here is saying that the franchise means something in Pennsylvania, that provisional ballots can, in fact, be used to address these situations where maybe, we don't know, maybe some of these mail-in ballots were defective under Pennsylvania law, but let's let people vote. Let them go ahead. Let's correct those problems that they may have had in some of these technical areas. And there are some other issues related to Pennsylvania provisional ballots. Provisional ballots, again, that would resurrect and ensure the franchise if in fact there are errors made with respect to these mail-in ballots of a technical nature. In all these cases coming out of Pennsylvania, nobody alleging that the ballots themselves were cast improperly, that somehow they're the subject of fraud. We're talking about technical, but nonetheless legal problems with some of them that can be identified to prevent the counting of those mail-in ballots. The Supreme Court just late Friday is saying, no, go ahead, give them those opportunities to submit provisional ballots and figure out whether or not their votes should count even as you're going ahead, Pennsylvania. Why is that significant? It is significant because, once again, Pennsylvania, unlike Virginia, is a battleground state. And it may well be that the thousands of voters who might have otherwise been disenfranchised by virtue of what the petitioners, what the challengers to this process have been articulating, if they had been disenfranchised, that could make the difference. That could make the difference in the electoral vote, the college vote coming out of Pennsylvania. And ultimately, as you all know well, Pennsylvania, like Wisconsin, like the other states, also in the swing state category, could make the difference in sending either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris to the White House. And so we've got this past week a bit of a split record, if you will, in Virginia. Go ahead and purge those voters again, requiring them, if they want to go in and re-register and vote. But in Pennsylvania, somewhat in the opposite direction, affirming the right to vote and permitting provisional ballots to overcome any identified problems in those cases. Many other courts around the country addressing right now specific issues that happen, again, because it is a matter of local and state and clerk-specific rules and regulations, election commissions making those decisions in the states about how it is the particular voting processes will go ahead. That's how we get all these different decisions coming out of a Supreme Court deciding and not deciding these cases. While this is going on, a couple of other date notes for you, calendar notes for you, and that is that the Supreme Court, which we haven't talked about a lot in terms of its major docket, is back in business again this coming week. It's got four different oral arguments coming up on Monday, the 4th, Tuesday, Election Day, November 5th, Wednesday, November 6th. It's got a case involving the Federal Communications Commission's Schools and Library Support Program. It's got a case involving Medicare compensation to hospitals. That's coming up on Tuesday, polling day. It's got another case under the Fair Labor Standards Act, also being argued on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, a case involving a class action lawsuit alleging securities fraud on the part of Facebook and corporate disclosures to shareholders. All of that coming up to be argued by the Supreme Court, even as we're going to the polls, early voting, absentee voting on Tuesday. And then yet this final Facebook challenge being entertained in oral argument on Wednesday. And the other date, also important to note, is that after the election, as we continue to observe what happens, we'll talk a lot about that in our broadcast next weekend, November 26th. Regardless of what happens on November 4th and days following, Donald John Trump, a defendant in that case in Manhattan, scheduled to be sentenced by Juan Merchan for his conviction for 34 counts of violations of New York law. A judge, Juan Merchan, sentencing Donald Trump on November 26th, right before Thanksgiving, for those violations. We'll talk more about that, all of that, as we address the rule of law in America here on Amicus, a Law Review. Vote, everybody, if you haven't already, on Tuesday, and revel in American democracy.
News from the Center, WRCE. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we will look back at the weekend's news and also preview the election coming up on Tuesday, a special edition. Join us then.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Rational Revolution with Mark Becker.
Liz Cheney, famous not Democrat, endorsed Kamala Harris for president.
I know that the most conservative of conservative values is fidelity to our Constitution.
Liz Cheney said that.
I tell you, I have never voted for a Democrat, but this year I am proudly casting my vote for Vice President Kamala Harris.
Patriotism above partisanship.
Listen to Rational Revolution with Mark Becker wherever you get your podcasts.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.